Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is a rebroadcast of a Brian Lehrer Show segment, so don't even think about calling in. But you can comment on our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. 89 the number, another summer. Sound of the funky drummer. Music hitting your heart, cause I know you got soul. Listen if you're missing, y'all. Swinging while I'm singing. And yes. I don't want to talk, I just want to listen to this. It was exactly 20 years ago that audiences around the country were introduced to Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing and its defining soundtrack there by Public Enemy. Now, two decades later, the Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood and the borough of Brooklyn that the film represents continue to deal with gentrification, which was one of the underlying conflicts depicted in that movie, and difficult questions of cultural understanding persist. But how much is the Bed-Stuy of 1989 the same as the Bed-Stuy of 2009, and how much have things changed? Joining us to discuss Do the Right Thing 20 years later are two writers for The Root, the online magazine of African-American culture and politics. Kai Wright is senior writer for The Root and recently wrote about the movie. We have a link to his piece on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Dayo Olapade is political reporter for The Root. She wrote about how Barack and Michelle Obama went to see Do the Right Thing on their first date together and what that might mean about how they see race. And we also welcome your thoughts, memories of the movie. How many times did you see it, and did your perception of it change over time? 212-433-WNYC. Did you go on your first date with your spouse to see Do the Right Thing? 212-433-9692. Kai and Dayo, welcome back to WNYC.
Glad to be here.
Hi. Great to be here again, Brian.
So, Kai, looking back, and maybe even for people who never saw Do the Right Thing, why was it so significant?
Oh, wow. First off, I'm 35, and anybody my age, this was a definitive movie in your teens, and listening to Public Enemy just there, it gives you chills every time it comes on. I think it was a time when we were really struggling, we still are, but we were really struggling to have this kind of conversation about anger in cities. And what that meant for the country and whether the anger was appropriate and how the anger was played out and whether it was self-destructive or not. So it was a lightning rod to come in and paint such a vivid picture of him.
And for people who've never seen it, the movie centers on the racial tensions really on one block in Bed-Stuy and ends with the burning to the ground of a white-owned pizza shop. And at the time, Dayo, many people talked about how it was the first time that many white members of the audience, because a lot of white people saw this movie. This was, a major
Spike
release,
Lee.
Mainstream Spike Lee movie. First time that many white members of the audience became aware of this black anger in these gentrifying neighborhoods. But you also write about how it was the first time that many black people from around the country became aware of this. How important was this movie for the black community?
Well, I think, the piece I wrote was about Michelle and Barack Obama's first date, and boy, would you love to be a fly on the wall for the conversation that followed.
I don't think I would want to be a fly anywhere near Barack Obama.
Good point. But I do think that there is a conversation about what happens when cultures collide. And, the segregated history of America gave way to, and is still a process of gentrification and interaction that really does raise serious questions that this movie tries to address. And again, a movie, the idea that it's a film where people can go and look at it and then keep the conversation going afterwards is, of course, Spike Lee's entire project. And so to have mixed races in theaters watching the film and then disappearing to their separate neighborhoods, might be not exactly what he intended, but certainly was a reality when the film came out.
Kai, you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I have to say, the thing about, as I remember distinctly at the time thinking, and I think it's still true now, is that the difficulty people had talking about the movie reflected was the whole point, right? I felt like people came out and took so different things from what it was about, from the movie, depending on who they were. It was, people could see it. We've had some conversations where people talk about it as a black nationalist manifesto, and I saw it as exactly the opposite, right? And so people saw the same movie and saw totally different stories.
And most of the white characters, by my viewing of it, were very sympathetic. There was almost no unsympathetic character in the movie. People were portrayed as, you know, maybe victims of their circumstances.
Everybody was trapped by their circumstances. Everybody was trapped by their emotions.
Right.
But again, I think having this film take place in the course of one day, in the course of one block, with a specific set of characters, underscores how intimate the relationships were. You know, Sal and Mookie, you know, work together. Jade, his sister, and Sal have a relationship. Everyone lives together and interacts. And so as much as you might want to classify folks by their race, they were more defined by where they lived and how they lived, they went about each day.
Right. So let's take a listen to a couple of the critical moments in the movie. In this one, there's a confrontation on the street between a white man and a black man, and eventually a crowd of black residents. It begins over someone's sneakers getting scuffed up. It eventually becomes about much more.
You almost knocked me down, man. The word is excuse me.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Not only did you knock me down, you stepped on my brand new white Air Jordans I just bought. And that's all you can say is excuse me. Who told you to step on my sneakers? Who told you to walk on my side of the block? Who told you to be in my neighborhood?
I own this brownstone.
Who told you to buy a brownstone on my block, in my neighborhood, on my side of the street? Yo, what you want to live in a black neighborhood for anyway, man? Gentrification.
Well,
no, I understand it. This is a free country. Man can live wherever he wants.
Free country? Man, I should... You're for saying that stupid shit alone.
Take his bike.
I should make you buy me another pair.
Black Panther, whoop his ass.
Take his bike. Kick his ass.
Man, you're lucky I'm a righteous black man. Otherwise, you'd be in serious trouble, man. Serious. Then why don't you move back to Massachusetts?
I was born in Brooklyn.
All right. And a little bit cleaned up so we don't lose our FCC license.
Right.
What are you thinking, Daya?
Well, I mean, what's really interesting is visually in that scene, the character is wearing a Larry Bird jersey, which I think is really interesting because, you know, back then there was a sort of a sharing of culture, right? You know, you had white basketball players, and now, you know, I feel as though that particular relationship must be completely different. I don't know what they would look like, you know, today, bugging out in the sky, having this argument. But I think things definitely have changed. That seems a bit anachronistic 20 years later to hear someone getting so angry about a sneaker that they're going to have, you know, a riot.
And you were both laughing. And I guess another thing to remember just in terms of the movie making is that even in the most deadly serious scenes, that movie is very funny.
Very funny.
It's very funny. And it's a comedic scene. And this is what I mean about it. It depends on where you're coming from when you take it. I thought that whole scene was mocking everybody involved. You know, I mean, it was,
right.
You know, there's – and I live in Bed-Stuy. And I actually – I think I can see that unfolding now. And
what?
But,
sneaker?
That kind of interaction over any small thing, but there's one of the best parts of that scene is that the only person really angry is bugging out. You know, everybody else just wants to see a fight. You know, and so they're prodding him on, and they're saying, "Come on, aren't you mad?" And the other guy, you know, the guy in the Larry Bird jersey is like, "Man, I'm just trying to go home. Leave me alone." Everybody's doing their own thing. And it's more silly than it is angry, frankly.
Jamie, I'm sorry. It's Norm in the West Village on Do the Right Thing at 20 years old. Hi, Norm.
Hi there. Thank you. I feel Do the Right Thing is undoubtedly a work of genius, and I was blown out of the movie theater when I first saw it. However, I think that not enough credit is given to Danny Aiello, who is notoriously difficult, and yet I think in this case fought for the integrity of his white characters. I think Spike Lee sometimes has difficulty being fair with his white characters and giving them full dimensionality. And I think the story goes he wanted Robert De Niro. Robert De Niro demurred but suggested Danny Aiello, and that is a very full, rich, deep, fully fleshed out white character that he portrays in that film. And I think it really adds to the power of the movie.
Thank you. Do either of you know if he had to fight for a fullness of that character on the screen? Do you know the behind-the-scenes story to that extent?
I don't
know the behind-the-scenes story, but I do, you know, just want to give Spike Lee a little bit of credit for working with a cast of young actors, a cast of extras that were, you know, a lot of them lived in Bed-Stuy that were from the neighborhood, and he wrote the movie, so, you know, you have to give him a little credit for both writing the part of Danny Aiello and then working with him to develop Sal into the character you admire so much. And I think just generally, you know, there's a whole cast of characters that come... that permute through all the different Spike Lee films. John Turturro is a good example. And I think, you know, Spike Lee, we wrote a piece on The Root about how he has a woman problem. But I'm not sure that I would go so far as to say he would have a white actor problem where those people aren't very fleshed out.
So let's hear a little bit of the John Turturro character. This is another clip from the movie, a conversation between Pino, that's the son of the white pizza owner, played by John Turturro, and Mookie, the black pizza delivery man, played by Spike Lee himself. It starts out as a fairly civil conversation about black leaders, but quickly devolves.
Anyway, Minister Farrakhan always talks about the so-called day when the black man will rise. We were one day, what does he say? We will one day rule the earth as we did in our glorious past.
Yeah, that's right.
What past you talking about? What did I miss?
We started civilization.
Man, keep dreaming, man. Then you woke up.
Pino, you, your pizza, and Frank Sinatra.
Yeah? Well, you too, and Michael Jackson.
Come in on that, Kai.
Have to do a lot to keep the FCC
here. Yeah, a lot of editing, but I think people get. I mean, the whole movie. It wasn't a 2-hour expose, but we also had to cut out the N word a lot, which the FCC would allow. Right. You know, but I just didn't want to hear or have to subject people to over and over again. Right. But it was so prevalent in that movie.
It was. I mean, well, first off, on that scene in particular, I mean, again, I think it's another example of the point which Zaya was making, is that the relationships are deeply intimate in this film. And I think that, to me, that is
really the point, isn't it?
And that's really the point of the whole movie, is that everybody is engaged in this deeply intimate dance with one another.
Right.
And working it out. And, you know, and as Radio Raheem tells us, you know, when it gets hot and things get difficult, sometimes love and hate get confused. They feel like the same emotion too often. And I think that's what we see in that scene and see throughout the film, is it's they're deeply intimate relationships. And I think that's a very real and very loving portrait of a neighborhood like Bed-Stuy, and I think that echoes still today.
I also think, you know, the relationship that you describe are so nuanced, they're so difficult, and they're so hard to discuss after the fact, that maybe this is part of the reason why the evolution of the movie. Maybe the Obamas didn't talk about the film. Today, I think we can have, I mean, we're not perfect and we're not post-racial, certainly, but the conversations are easier. There's a lot more vocabulary about this kind of relationship. But back in 1989, to see this kind of movie and not feel deeply uncomfortable or alienated or militant, you know, maybe was tough. And I think that it might be hard to explain this scene between Turturro and Spike Lee to the voters in Iowa, you know, and so I think that's why the president sort of danced away from having, you know, really had this movie be quite important to him and his wife.
And how did we learn that this was their first date?
Well, the president has had a couple of different versions of his first date. They went to ice cream, and they went to see a movie. They went to the John Hancock in Chicago. But actually, our editor-in-chief at The Root, Henry Louis Gates, had the Obamas over and Spike Lee over in Martha's Vineyard in 2004, where the president told Spike Lee that he owed him one because during the movie, Michelle had let him touch her knee. And so that was his first little instance where he sort of saw a little crack in the door and quickly walked through it. But the movie, you know, and I was told by various acquaintances of the Obamas and friends of theirs from Chicago and the White House that they love the movie. You know, they've seen it a bunch of times, and it's important to them. It's just kind of tough to talk about it when you have to bleep everything out.
I'm just trying to think of which scene was romantic enough to make his move during.
Oh, Brian, I think you know.
Could have involved ice cubes.
I guess there was one. Yeah, I'm thinking here's a whole movie where people are, you know, accusing each other of things, having fights, burning down stores, calling each other the N-word, and he's putting the moves on somebody.
But in the scenes where they're not doing that, they're loving each other. That's the thing. Every scene, there's either conflict or love going on. And again, sometimes they get confused.
Can you draw any line from the movie's vision of racial politics to the president's current vision of racial politics, or is that just way too simplistic?
I mean, I think Washington is a great example. Natalie Hopkinson, who's our associate editor, wrote a story about gentrification in her neighborhood. Kai wrote a fantastic piece about Brooklyn. These same conflicts are happening in microcosm across the country. We might have a little bit better chance at resolving some of the issues, but they persist.
And Natalie's piece on The Root says, remembers that one of the black residents of the block pleads with Sal, the white pizza owner, to put up pictures of black leaders on his restaurant walls, and that to her that seems really dated. Today we would ask, why doesn't Buggin' Out just open his own restaurant?
Right?
So maybe that's a little optimistic.
Well, maybe Buggin' Out doesn't have the capital still today anymore than he had then.
All right. Do the right thing. Now 20 years old. So Kai and Dio from The Root, thank you both very much.
Take care, Brian. Thanks for having us on.
Kai Wright, Dia Olapade, TheRoot.com, right? Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.